Hey, deserving listeners, it's just me today. I received an email recently from someone emailing in as a client saying that her and her therapist are maybe starting a romantic sexual type of relationship. And so I thought I would review that email in this episode and talk about all the different things that need to be discussed when we talk about this sort of thing. So let's get into it. This email is from an anonymous YouTube member. She says, I would like your opinion on my therapist. I feel like there is a lot of transference, countertransference going on, but I've never been in therapy before, so I don't know if it's normal. I didn't expect such a strong emotional connection with my therapist, so maybe I'm just overanalyzing it. I started therapy about 5 months ago. So it sounds like for the first time, 5 months ago, started therapy. I'm a 40-year-old female with two children. I have been in an abusive marriage since I met my husband in high school. Okay, so she's 40, two kids, currently married, and she's saying abusive, and she's been with him since high school. So 20 plus years. I found a therapist and wanted my kids to go to therapy as well. So the therapist sees all three of us separately. So sees the mom, the emailer, and also her two kids. I thought this was normal, but I've recently been told that it's not. Okay, just chiming in. So I'm guessing that you might have been asking around about this transference, countertransference, or maybe something else, and people are saying to you that it's not normal, or maybe even claiming it's unethical for your therapist to see you and your two kids all individually in therapy. And the way people talk about this is absurd. People, even ethics teachers sometimes miss the mark on this. When you actually talk to people who adjudicate these kinds of things or who litigate these things in court or who review these things for licensing boards, they will never tell you that it's unethical for a therapist to see a mom and her two kids individually. There are pros and cons to it. There is a con in that what if one of the kids wants to confide in the therapist about the mom and the kid feels afraid that to do that because the kid might feel like the therapist is on the mom's side or that the mom's going to find out about it or something, you know, that confidentiality. Another con is that as a therapist, it would be hard to remember what is confidential. Now, sometimes you can mitigate that by just, you know, having an ROI, having an agreement between all three people that you can disclose information and share. But, you know, again, that degrades the sanctity of the confidentiality agreement that you can have with clients. You know, there's a lot of benefit to that. There's various other cons as well. But the pros are that the therapist is pretty intimate with the family system. So when the therapist is talking to one of the kids, the therapist knows in their mind other stories or context that will help the kid. You know, one scenario that I would run into is, say you have a teenager that is complaining about their parents being strict. And I am a family therapist who works with everyone. I don't know if I ever did actually just flat out see people individually. What I would do is I would treat families and I would occasionally meet individually with different members of the family. And one of the benefits to that would be that if the teenager was complaining to me about the parent, then I wouldn't, you know, because if I was just an individual therapist with the teenager, I would listen and do it everything. I would do everything I could to help the kid, but I wouldn't be able to do much beyond that. As a family therapist that is also seeing the parents, I could literally go to the parents in the next session and say, so your kid complained about this and that. And I would always ask the kids, like, do you want me to talk with your parents about this? And for some people, they'd be like, well, that's triangulation. Yeah, but there are functional triangulations. And there's also just helping families, you know, getting the ball rolling between, especially when family members can create so much animosity and conflict that it's hard for them to get back on track without someone in between at first. Anyway, so I could go, you know, I'd ask the kids, so do you want me to talk to the parents? And the kid might say, well, what are you going to say? And I would tell the kid what I was going to say. And the kid would say, okay, yeah, that'd be good. And then I go to the parents and I would say, look, you know, your kid complained about you in the following way. I'm not saying that your kid is right or wrong, but in the effort of open communication, I thought I would help to do this so that we could build some trust so the two of you can actually talk. Or I would open the conversation in the next family session. You know, I'd be like, so Johnny, last time we talked, we agreed that you would bring up the following thing, the complaint to your parents. So go ahead. Why don't you complain to your parents now? And, you know, there's a lot of benefit to having one therapist who is treating multiple members of a system. You know, and the list goes on. But what you'll hear from people almost universally is it's unethical for a therapist to see a mom and the two kids individually at the same time. And no book says that. That it's unethical to do that. No review board is, particularly for family therapists, but you know, even for individual therapists, there are cautions, there are considerations, there are situations when you probably should not do that. Like if, for example, the mom was abusive, then to have the to have the you know, the mom and the kids with the same therapist could make the kids feel less safe, that kind of thing. And this really drives me nuts, particularly as a family therapist, because our whole profession is based on having the option, when clinically and ethically sound to do so, to see multiple members of a family in the same room and to have different configurations, different, you know, subgroups of the family. You see just the parents or just the kids or just one parent, one of the kids, or even just one of the kids, and you meet individually with them at times. And to have outsiders and other professionals in my field claim that it's unethical to do so, it's like, you know, family therapy has been around in earnest since the 70s. So let's wake up. It's sort of like if you're a psychiatrist and of the vast majority of people, including people in our industry, say that prescribing pills is unethical. It's like our whole industry is based on this. Why do you think we have this profession called marriage and family therapy when if the entire profession is unethical at its core? You know, it's really disheartening. And I'll even hear people in marriage and family therapy that will claim it's unethical to see multiple people individually. So there are things to think about, but it's not unethical. The amount of crap that I see on Reddit and on the internet about what is and what is not is ethical is it's astounding just how many misinformed, stupid people there are out there. And it's really disheartening. And I blame it on our profession because there are answers, there are experts, there are people who can actually speak to these issues with intelligence, but somehow we don't elevate them or listen to them enough or care to ask them what their opinion is. We all just spout. I find that a lot of therapists just spout. They just say like, it's unethical because they think it is, or they feel that, you know, and they're insecure and they can't tolerate not knowing and they don't know who to ask. I mean, I know that was me for many years in the beginning of my career. When I ran into an ethical dilemma or question, I didn't know who to ask. I could look up the codes and read it, but it's not very clear. There are so many. I would say the vast majority of ethical dilemmas that we run into as therapists, or questions that we run into, in our ethical codes, it does not help to read the ethical codes. The ethical codes are very baseline. They're very just fundamental things, you know, like you will respect your clients. You will try to uphold confidentiality unless there's a reasonable reason that you would break confidentiality. You will not have sex with your clients, you know, real basic shit. And almost nothing about the various different situations that are, you know, talked about in our field regarding what is and what is not ethical. Anyway, so getting back to you, remember, you're 40, you're in an abusive marriage, you go to therapy for yourself, your two kids, and moving on here. Here are some things that have been said and happened over the last 5 months. Okay, I think the rest of this is all about the transference, countertransference. My first session, my therapist asked me if I was famous. He had mentioned a few times in various sessions that I reminded him of an actress. One day after one of our sessions, he messaged me and said he remembered it, and it was a movie called Salt. The main character in that movie is Angelina Jolie, arguably the most beautiful woman on the planet. I scoffed and said, "Yeah, right, I wish." And he insisted that I looked like Angelina Jolie and said I needed to increase my confidence. Okay, well, just chiming in here, you know, I'm guessing this gets worse as we go through this, but just that on its own, it's not necessarily a problem. And if it makes you feel uncomfortable, which I don't know if it did at the time, then just tell him. Just say, hey, you know, I don't want to talk about my appearance in therapy. You know, thanks for the compliment, but it's not really why I'm here. It's a hard thing to do to say to a therapist, honestly, but if there's a relationship where you should be able to say something like that and be safe and get a very good therapeutic response, it would be with a therapist. So, but anyway, moving on. He asked about my sex life with my husband. He asked if I'm satisfied with my sex life with my husband. Once he told me that I should stop at a sex store on the way home to grab some plastic toys. Later, he told me that he was a sex therapist for 6 years. Just chiming in here. Okay, we're starting to hear some minor yellow flags. For some people, this would be a slam dunk indication of an unethical thing that's happening. It's not necessarily, and we'd really have to hear what was said and how it was said and what the justifications were. You know, there's nothing wrong with a therapist raising the topic of one's sexual life. Now, of course, the therapist should be careful, particularly if it's a male therapist and a female client, that there should be a lot of care around, like, so I'm going to ask you a question. Do not feel like you have to answer it. I'm just wondering if you wanted to talk about your sex life or how satisfied you are. I'm not going to ask you, you know, this is me talking as a therapist. I'm not going to ask you questions in detail. And at any time, you can just say, I don't want to answer that. But I think it might be, if you want to, helpful to you if you could explore your sexual satisfaction in your life. And we could talk about maybe what you could do to improve it or something. Is that something you want to talk about? is that okay? Yeah, absolutely. So did that happen? Or is this the beginning of a pattern? Because if it is, then yikes. But if not, then it's totally fine. But again, if it makes you feel uncomfortable, then you should always just say, hey, you know, I don't really want to talk about that right now. Or that's not really why I'm here. And if I asked a question of that nature and a client told me that they weren't comfortable, I would bend over backwards to apologize and say, yeah, totally, I'm sorry. Here's why I was asking that question. And thank you for telling me that you're uncomfortable talking to me. You know, I totally respect that. And, you know, I'll make sure to not go in that road again, or if I do, I'll really just make sure that you are comfortable even beginning to go down that road. You know, so going back through email, he gives me a lot of compliments, my therapist. He tells me I'm beautiful on the inside and out. I shaved my head, and one day I came in with my wig on, and he said I was gorgeous. He told me I'm a wonderful mother and that I'm a rare find, and he told me to never change. One day, he was looking at me with this look on his face, and I asked what it was, and he said he was admiring me. Just chiming in. Again, okay, I'm guessing this is a ramp up to it getting worse, which is, then it really changes this. But if I just heard this, then it's not necessarily a problem. If you're uncomfortable with it, then by all means, say so. But for a therapist to, so I don't do this. I feel like in my 25 years or almost 30 years as a therapist, I've probably only had a handful of times where I've ever had a reason enough to talk about a client's appearance. I avoid it for a variety of reasons. One, because it's not a topic that is even on the table as an option, or there's no real reason to comment on someone's appearance or how attractive they are or something. But I feel like years and years ago, I remember thinking in my mind, like, I don't want to do this right now, but I feel like it would help the client if I did tell them that they were indeed attractive. The only thing I can think of as to why, I don't even know if I did it at the time, but I do remember having that thought in my head. And the only reason why I would have thought that was because I would have thought it was the only way to help someone overcome their distorted idea of themselves as a disgusting, ugly person or something. And, there's a tactful way of doing it, right? Where it's just like, look, I'm a human being as well as a therapist, and I'm not saying that I'm attracted to you, but because that's not really how I am as a therapist. But I will say that you are objectively attractive, I'm guessing, to a lot of people. So the fact that you see yourself as a disgusting, person, I've been trying various different ways to counter the way that you see yourself, which I think is interfering with your self-esteem and also interfering with your relationships and the possibility of relationships. I've been trying various different things to combat that, and I'm going to continue to keep doing those things. But I also just hope that maybe I can just say this one thing and it will help us get down this road of, I'm pretty sure I would bet a lot of money that a lot of people, if I were to poll them on how they saw you as on a scale from 1 to 10, that a lot of people would put you pretty high up there, certainly much higher than you see yourself. End of role play. That would be the way that I might say it. And I wouldn't say I'm attracted to you or you're beautiful to me. Now, another therapist might do that. I have known therapists, it sounds creepy, but I know male therapists who can absolutely pull that off in a fatherly or grandfatherly way. I know this one therapist who is beloved by everybody, and he's a very much of a grandfather figure, and he absolutely has said things like that to people, clients, and students right in front of me. And they eat it up. And I would talk with the students after these interactions, and they would just speak glowingly about this professor. We don't usually hear about those kinds of vibes in our society. We tend to basically see men in this context in one of two ways. It's just like there are two kinds of men. You have men who refrain from saying such things, and then you have groomers who do say those sorts of things. You know what I mean? I think there's a wide variety of types of people or motivations or vibes that people can give off if they're going to compliment you. But if I just heard this bit from someone, a client saying, my therapist told me, let's read this back. He says that I'm beautiful on the inside and out, and he said I was gorgeous with my wig on. He told me I'm a wonderful mother and that I'm a rare find and to never change. The thing to never change, I mean, it's kind of weird because that's why you go to therapy, right? But I'm guessing maybe the communication was, you know, don't change your appearance or something, or you don't need to change for someone to love you or something. One of the changes that might be happening that a therapist might be building towards is you don't need to change to love yourself. What you need to change is how you see yourself. Like, you don't actually have to change, but your view of yourself should change to meet up with reality that you're a good person. You don't need to change. Anyway, and then he said, looking at me, he was admiring me. Yeah, you know, it's hard to tell, but I'm guessing this gets worse here. All right, let's take a break. All right, going on. He has told me that I will have no problems getting a man. He said if I put a blast on Facebook, everyone would be asking for a date. He has made it very clear that he is attracted to me. He even told me in our last session that I was attractive. All right, just chiming in. Yeah, this is a problem. This is when I start to get upset at this therapist and other therapists. And I'm not there. If this therapist were here to defend himself, he might be able to convince me. But I've seen this a lot, that it's almost like there are two mindsets in my field. Both are wrong. On one side of the fence, you have people saying that it's unethical to be attracted to your clients, and there's something wrong with you if you're attracted to your clients, and you should never admit to anyone, colleagues or clients or anyone, if you do have an attraction to a client, because that means you're some sort of disgusting pervert or something. And obviously that's wrong. And then on the other side of the fence, you have people who are like, if you're attracted to a client, you should immediately tell them, because if you don't, it's crazy making or gaslighting to a client, because they'll detect it. But if you don't, if you deny it, then you're actually driving them crazy. So you should just admit it, and you should just deal with it up front and make it part of the therapy. Again, this is stupid. It's short-sighted. It's simple-minded. Now, can you bring it up in therapy? Sure. But a lot of things have to happen before you as a therapist just blurt out that you're attracted to a client. You should get pretty, you know, comprehensive consultation, supervision, and or therapy to sift through those feelings. Number two, you should have been noticing those feelings earlier on, possibly even in the first session. It'd be weird for an attraction like that to just emerge later down the line. Of course it could, but usually it emerges right away for therapists. So that's another thing. The other thing is that when you do tell a client, which always needs to be in service of the client and not yourself as a therapist, then it has to be predetermined how you're going to do that and why. And then there has to be a whole amount of attention and space made for the client to explore how that feels to them and the impact on therapy that that's going to have. It can be done, and it might actually help the therapy. It's not common that it would be wise to do so, because at the very least, it's a distraction to the client, but it's also, potentially really distracting and also threatening to a client. So can you talk to your clients about attraction? Yeah. But if you did, it would have to be something like, I have to admit, you know, like, I'm trying to think of a common scenario. So let's say that you have a therapist who pretty quickly realizes they're attracted to their client and is trying to suppress it. Oh, you know, let it go. And then a few sessions down the line, he's thinking, I keep thinking about this client. uh-oh, I think I'm having some countertransference here that is of an erotic or romantic nature. And, okay, I need to talk with my colleague. And, you know, he goes to his colleague and, I'll just use myself. This has literally never happened because for whatever, you know, I've studied a lot of the research on the prevalence of this kind of attraction to clients. And it's, you know, it's fairly high for people of all genders as therapists, but to varying degrees, right? You know, there's extremely mild attraction to obsessive attraction to a client. And it's a, you know, it's a fairly common experience, particularly if you're a therapist with enough people over time. And for me, though, I don't know if it ever has happened in my life. There's just something about being a therapist that it turns that off for me. I've noted that, this person is attractive, but it just, I feel like there's so much, you know, it's sort of be like what I imagine a first responder might feel like if you're an emergency medical professional and you arrive at a car accident and you come up on one person's very injured and it's the husband and the wife, or let's say it's two women friends and one woman is very injured and the friend was also in the car, but she's unscathed. She's fine. And let's say the unscathed woman is very attractive. Well, to a first responder, I'm guessing, you know, in the back of their mind, they might note that the uninjured person is attractive, but there's so many other things that you're panicking about, you know, or not panicking necessarily, but that you're concentrating on, right? You're trying to save someone's life. You're thinking about a lot of medical things and monitoring. That's how I am as a therapist. I'm not panicking as a therapist, but I'm focused so much, or I suppose it's more akin to say, a medical professional, like, I don't know, a proctologist or something, or a gynecologist or a OBGYN or I don't know, just a general practitioner, that, you know, you're there to do a job and you're not just casually hanging out. So, I don't know. That's the only, anyway, point is that it's pretty common. But anyway, so let's say that it was me. And I had that experience that I said earlier. Well, I would immediately talk to Bob. I would say, hey, we got to talk. And so I would start to lay out my feelings and I would just kind of ramble and he would listen and ask questions. And he'd probably ask like, well, do you think this is going to be doable? Do you think you should refer her out? Or is it possible that you might be able to keep this under wraps and not let her? Because the other factor is, well, if this becomes a focus in my head, it'll interfere with treatment. I won't be able to concentrate on treatment, or I'll be constantly second guessing my treatments. Like, am I only saying this because I'm attracted to her, or is it something else? You know, there are considerations. And so I would have that conversation, and let's say that I determine that, you know, I can manage. And then I say, well, let's set up a time, you know, every couple of weeks where I'll check in with you with this. And then I proceed with treatment. And in my head, I'm just like, well, maybe it'll go away. And let's say it doesn't. Let's say it kind of gets worse. Like as I get to know her, she's, you know, mentally compelling. You know, her personality is very attractive too. And I find myself late at night. I'm really uncomfortable using myself in this scenario, but I'll just keep going. Because this has never happened to me. But you know, it's late at night, and I'm just thinking about her. You know, or I'm, you know, it's that lovey feeling. Ugh, I can't imagine having this. It's just so, you know, it's normal to have it at times, but I just can't imagine. Anyway. So then I go back to Bob. I'm like, oh, it's getting worse. You know, I'm thinking about her at night. And then, you know, we talk about how to make sure the frame of therapy is upheld. And, you know, we talk about maybe referring out again. And let's say we decide not to refer out, but I am you know, reminding myself, don't go over on sessions, don't text her outside of session. That's just a temptation to start kind of having a back and forth, which is the beginning of the slippery slope for these sorts of things. I might want to go into therapy to figure out, like, what is it about me that why am I attracted to his client so much? You know, is it just a cigar is a cigar that we, you know, if we did meet in real life, might we have hit it off? Is it just that, or is there something about her that's hooking me in a pathological way? How are my relationships going? That would be the main question, because that usually is what's happening, that, you know, therapists who do this sort of thing are often going through a divorce and drinking a lot. So looking at those factors would be important. And let's say I do all that work, and let's say I'm single at the time, and my relationships aren't going so well, and, you know, you can't just snap your fingers and fix that sort of thing. Maybe even in therapy, I'm going through kind of a difficult period with what we're talking about, like some major trauma or loneliness stuff. And I talk with my therapist about the transference or the counter transference I'm having with the client. And let's say I determine that for a variety of reasons, it just would not be in the best interest of the client for me to refer them out. You know, there's some reasons why that might be the case. Okay. So after all that, this is, you know, probably 3, 4, 5 months in, eventually I tell my therapist and Bob that I think my client can tell. I think she can tell, because the way I look at her, she actually asked me what I was looking at. She had this, you know, this look, and she had this question. God, you know, even as I get to this point, I'm still like, why the fuck would I tell the client? It'll just muddy the waters. It'll just make it weird for the client, you know? Why would I want to dump it on the client? But okay, I'm trying to really force my, I'm sure there's another scenario, but I'm too COVID mind to think of another one. So let's say that we determine that I'm going to tell the client. So I plan out how I'm going to say it. And then I say to the client, look, you know, the other day you asked, yeah, so maybe it was that, like the client asked, you know, you seem to look at me sometimes and it seems like you're trying to tell me something with your eyes or something. And let's say that I determined that I probably was, but in the moment with the client, I'm like, no, that I don't know what you're talking about. And then the client, there's a relationship rupture there, because the client feels one thing, but I'm telling her another thing. And I determined that for the client's interest, I should come clean so that the client isn't made to feel crazy for their instincts. You know, maybe it's a part of the client's issue that they came in for me for, that people had gaslit them seriously before, and here I am doing it to her again. So I'm like, okay. So next session, I say, so I thought a lot about what you said last week, how you said I was looking at you in a particular way, and you seem to be very convinced of that, and you had cited other kind of vibes that I'd had with you in previous sessions, and then you asked me about it, and I said that there wasn't anything there. Well, I felt guilty afterwards, because I was kind of lying to you, and I think you might have felt that I was deceiving you, and I really don't want to make you feel like I'm deceiving you or that I'm discounting you or gaslighting you. So I talked with my therapist. This is me talking, isn't there? I talked with my therapist. I talked with a colleague of mine, and I've been talking about this issue for a long time. And we all determined that I would tell you this, which is that I do indeed have an attraction to you, but nothing will ever happen between us because I'm your therapist and I'm here to help you. And I take my ethical codes very seriously and my duty very seriously. But I don't want you to have an experience with me where you're experiencing something from me, a vibe from me, and then you ask me about it, and then I just lie to you that it's not there. So that's the only reason why I'm telling you. I'm dealing with it. Long story short, it's because you know, there are some issues in my life that helping you kind of triggers, and so I think that's what's happening here. At no point in our lives, even after therapy, will we ever even be in a friendship, because I take these relationships very seriously. I take therapy very seriously. But for the sake of your treatment and for the sake of not lying to you, I'm telling you that when you asked me that question the other day, you might be right, that I might actually kind of have a vibe with you. I know this is kind of a big deal to say in therapy, and I apologize because, you know, I've been trying to, because this happens sometimes, you know, attraction sometimes happens for therapists, but usually you can kind of wait it out and it'll go away, especially if you're consulting about it and that sort of thing. But this one didn't really go away. So, you know, I'm sorry for lying to you last week. Do you forgive me? And also, how does it feel to hear me say that? So, end of role play. That's the full scenario, right? Where I could imagine maybe it would be justified. It's still highly questionable whether or not it's worth it to reveal to the client for kind of a minor rupture there. You know, another thing that I could have said would be like, look, I want to apologize for last week. You asked me if I had a vibe with you, and I said I didn't. And I was a little dismissive of it. What I will say is that I think of you, I just have a lot of admiration for you. I think you're a great person. I'm not attracted to you because I'm your therapist, but so end of role play. This is me half answering, half being true, but also half lying to for the sake of the client, you know, so that they aren't, you know, confused or pulled out of their therapy or, you know, threatened in any way. This is my problem that I'm having. It's not her problem. So that's always the consideration. It's like, if I'm going to self-disclose or if I'm going to do anything in therapy, what's the best choice for the client? And then when I leave the office, then I have to deal with my shit. You know what I mean? So the two camps that I will often hear are there's something wrong with you for being attracted to a client, which isn't true, or always tell your client. And I'm like, no and no. That you might tell your client under very strict circumstances after much consultation and therapy. And even then, it's questionable as to whether or not that's in the best interest of the client. Having said all that, there is another scenario, like the grandfatherly vibe, that is totally legit, that I've never really tried to adopt, which is that, you know, a grandfatherly sort of person could say to a female client, I do have, you know, I am attracted to you. Not that anything will ever happen, but you are a beautiful, gorgeous person. And if I were 50 years younger and not your therapist, I would have absolutely wanted to go on a date with you. And that's it. That's all you say, right? And you mean it, you know, as a grandfatherly 75-year-old therapist talking to a 30-year-old woman who you determine as a therapist might benefit from a little self-esteem boost, and you know that the client won't misinterpret it or be creeped out by it, and it's in the service of the client. So, you know, it's in the service of the client. Could you pull that off? Yeah, you could. You know, there's legitimacy to that. You'd have to be very self-aware and you know, because it's not like 75-year-old therapists and 30-year-old clients don't have improprieties and relationships outside of therapy, because they do. But if you know that about yourself, and you know that the client, and you've, you know, predetermined that the client isn't at risk of confusion or threat or something along those lines, then, you know, you could do that in the service of a client. So anyway, going on with your, so you tell us, anonymous YouTube member, that, well, let's take a break. All right, we're back from the break. So what were you telling us? He says that he has made it very clear that he is attracted to me. Okay. Yeah. I don't know what the circumstances were. Maybe he is talking to his therapist and a consultant, but it doesn't sound like it, but who knows? Going on with your email. I once said something along the lines to him about us hanging out, and I knew that we couldn't. Sorry, I read that weird. I think COVID makes it hard for me to read. I feel like I'm reading really in a labored manner. Let me try to make the font bigger. I once said something along the lines to him about us hanging out, but I knew that we couldn't hang out. He said I was going to make him lose his license because he really wants to hang out. Just chiming in. Okay, yeah, ugh. There's no reason to even think that, let alone say it, to tell a client that, yeah, I want to hang out outside of therapy with you too, but, you know, oh boy, you're going to make me lose my license. Yikes. Just, what are you doing? Going on. Most of my appointments, shouldn't that be a red flag to a therapist if you're even thinking such a thing, let alone saying it out loud? Like, I might lose my license. Do you think maybe that's a time to check in with yourself? Not only with this client, but maybe just take a full inventory of what the fuck is wrong with your personality going on. Most of my, and that usually is the case. I've worked with people both professionally and also as a podcaster with cases like this. And it seems to me that therapists who go down these roads have something significantly wrong with their personality, that there's something going on there. There's so many things that you would have to overlook within your own soul and training to proceed down a road like this. Cause it's not just a sudden thing. You heard me describe in that scenario I laid out of all the things that I would experience of just like, oh, I think I'm attracted to this person. I would notice right away in the first session. And then I think, well, maybe it'll go away. We'll see how it goes second session. Second, third session, it's still there. That's when I immediately consult with someone. And, there's so many things that will happen to a therapist that we are obviously supposed to be aware of and take action around, some sort of action. And these people that go down these roads don't hesitate for a second, and they blow past literally thousands of alerts that are trying to tell them to stop and think. And they just don't. There's something wrong with someone. Of course, psychopathy comes to mind, but it also could just be actual narcissism, not the internet version. God, the amount of bullshittery on the internet around narcissism, it's getting worse and worse. It's really stark. 4 years ago, it was bad. But now it's just constant, particularly if you're on TikTok and shit. I mean, it is awful. I mean, it's bizarre. How did this word narcissist or narcissism basically just completely replace what people used to on the internet call sociopath or sociopathy, which is at least closer to the mark, even though the vast majority of forensic psychologists don't use the term sociopath or sociopathy. We use the terms psychopathy or psychopath or antisocial. And all the bullshittery around the distinctions between these three constructs are really quite alarming as well on the internet, even among clinicians, by the way. So it's really bizarre. And also, I think it's harmful because the way they talk about a narcissist is that I think it's like a cartoon version of the way that TV shows and movies, you know, like the TV show You on Netflix, I think it was. It's like people watch too many movies like Hannibal Lecter and stuff, where it just constructs this notion of personality, and then people start applying it to everyone that bothers them, particularly in relationships. It's like, you know, yeah, I had my boyfriend, I was with him, and he said he loved me, but then one day he cheated on me, and then he broke up with me, as if he just didn't care. He must be a narcissist. He's been grooming me from the beginning. He's been manipulating me from the very start. And you're like, well, wait, so what? I mean, maybe, but it's more likely that he's a regular human just like you, and he fell in love with you, and he cheated, which is what a lot of people do, unfortunately. And he is lying to himself because he's ashamed of himself and he doesn't want to believe that he's a bad person. So he made justifications up in his mind that it was okay to cheat on you or to break up with you in the way that he did. And it's kind of eating away at him on the inside, but consciously he's justifying it in various different ways. And everyone does that. You've done that. You just don't want to admit that you've done it. That doesn't make someone, one, narcissistic, and two, your version of a narcissist, which is basically someone who wakes up in the morning and it is on a master plan to ruin people's lives, you know? Did this person ruin your life? Yeah, it sounds like it. I'd be devastated if I were in your shoes, but where's this weird? Yeah, I've been over this anyway. So anyway, I'm talking about the sort of people that go down these roads, and it's you know, it's not that severe, right? That typically, like, I'll give one example. There was someone I was working with who had this problem. She was a professional, mental health professional, and had an ongoing relationship with a client, and when she was discovered by officials and sanctioned and outed in a variety of ways, long story short, she didn't really absorb the situation even after she was caught as a mental health professional, such that a year or two later, she was doing it again or something like that. I can't remember the details. And she would make these excuses about it. She would say things like, well, this time it's different, or I don't understand why I can't have a relationship, or, you know, these really just simplistic statements. And she was very smart too. She was a very smart, very accomplished professional, but the mental gymnastics that's indicative of trauma and of personality characterological disorders, was so severe. You know, when I talk about personality disorders, distortion is a hallmark. If you're OCPD, the distortion is that because you have this flawed behavior, you made this one mistake or this one imperfection, or you might, then the world is coming to an end and no one will ever love you. You don't consciously feel that way, but you do feel that way and you do distort it. You know, if you're Bob and you believe that you're dirty to the core and no one would ever love you if they really do, that's a distortion. If you're borderline and you think that people are abandoning you left and right and secretly want to break up with you all the time, even though that's not the truth, that's a distortion, right? So for these individuals that are having at least chronic affairs with clients, there's a distortion. There's something going wrong there, right? And yeah, it's upsetting that they don't get the help they need. Because certainly people with personality disorders and distortions can be excellent therapists and very ethical. It's upsetting when people don't take the time or put in the effort or have the supervision or mentorship to guide them to monitor this kind of thing. Anyway, so most of my appointments are on Fridays because the day works out best for me. After the last two sessions in the early evening, he called me and asked me if I wanted to come back to the office and talk to him some more, but I declined. Just chiming in here. Yeah, this is a classic sign of the slippery slope of a therapist abusing a client. It's one of the classics. In fact, now that we've gotten to this point, let's review all the classic signs that we've seen so far. So just talking about this classic sign is, so you start with a client as a client, and the frame of therapy is being upheld, right? There's no boundary crossings at all. And in our lingo, we have boundary crossings and boundary violations. So I'll kind of be, violations are worse than crossings, essentially. And so that's on one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum is sleeping with your client. Okay. So the slippery slope, and research finds that, because there was a pretty extensive set of research that looked at how do these things happen? How do you go from being a client to being someone's lover? And isn't the word lover, it's kind of funny, but sometimes that's the word they use in literature. You know, seeing this very uptight journal article in this academic publication will use the word lover. Anyway, so what they found in the research was that almost always there's this progression, this slippery slope. And what you'll find is that there will be a little bit more contact outside of the session. There will be, face-to-face contact out of the session. And at some point you meet outside of the office, right? Where you go to a coffee shop, you know, you make up some excuse or there's, anyway, my brain isn't working quite right. I think COVID is catching up with me. But some of the classic signs are he's calling you and asking if you want to come back to the office to talk with him some more. So it's not going to a restaurant. It's not going to a hotel room. It's just in his office. But it definitely is a boundary crossing. Now, would it be okay for a therapist to do that? Absolutely. There might be a situation where a therapist, you know, like and I used to do this kind of work because my schedule allowed for it. It doesn't anymore, and it hasn't for a long time. But if I had a major if I had a major relationship rupture with a client, say on a Tuesday, and by Wednesday or Thursday, I'm just like, ooh, you know, let's say it's a borderline client, and I really cared about this client. We had this rupture and it was my fault. And I'm thinking, if I wait all the way until Tuesday, there's a chance that the client will downward spiral so much mood-wise and also with our relationship that they'll never come back again. So I've got to nip this in the bud. So I might actually call the client and say, hey, I really want to talk about what happened last session and I want to apologize, but I want to do it in person. And I don't want to wait until Tuesday. So how about we make an emergency session tomorrow on Friday? Is that okay with you? And I won't charge you for it. Might I do something like that? Yeah. I don't know if I ever did, but I could see myself doing that. Yeah, so that's okay. But if it's in the midst of all this other stuff, like I'm attracted to you, I'm admiring you, you look like Angelina Jolie, you're going to make me lose my license. You're gorgeous. You're a rare find. it's just all the classic signs. And for the record, some of you might think that, you know, therapists like this are predators, and certainly that's one way of looking at it. The vast majority of therapists who do this sort of thing are not Machiavellian psychopaths. There's something wrong with them, and they end up, in the same way that everyone else does, falling in love with their clients such that it clouds their judgment. And so they're, in their heart, they are restraining themselves a lot they can't help it, right? The relationship is, and they start to convince themselves, you know, it's just like, well, therapy's almost over with this client, and you know, it's okay to socialize a little bit with a client now and then. And then eventually the person saying, look, you know, we terminated therapy now. We can date now. It's okay, you know, according to ethical codes. And if you really look at the ethical codes of all the professions, it's clear that it's not just this blanket open check that says, you know, past this certain point. Because in the ethical, various different professions, they'll lay out a time span of just like, you can't, you know, socialize or have a romantic relationship with a client unless you have been terminated for X amount of years, right, as clients. I believe in marriage and family therapy, I did a whole review of all the different professions. I think in marriage and family therapy, there's it says never, essentially, you know, because some of them say like 1 year or 2 year or 7 years. But I think in marriage and family therapy, they're just like never, like it just stop. Even then, if you do wait the amount of time, it still needs to be within the client's interest, meaning that you, as a professional, if you were to date a former client, you would have to have determined that it's not going to ultimately harm the client, the former client. And, you know, that's a hard thing to determine. So what I always say is, you know, just there's a lot of fish in the sea, and stop dating former clients. There's no reason to do that. Also, the fact that you're attracted to a client, you know, is probably an issue in and of itself. Like, there's a top-down nature to that relationship that is not, you know, conducive to a fair relationship. And that is often what will happen in these relationships, is the client will, you know, the former client will start to want things in return, you know, like, I would like you to admire me, you know, because often there's a lot of admiration from client to therapist, right? And it therapists who narcissistically need that might seek to date clients because clients already start out worshiping them in a certain way, and then when that that balance, that scale is attempted to be balanced by the former client as things move forward. Oftentimes the therapist can't tolerate that, and then they end it. That's not always the case, but anyway, going on. He lets me stay late after our sessions if the next client hasn't come yet. Just chiming here. Yeah, another classic sign, staying late. In and of itself, really nothing. I always tell my colleagues and my supervisees that you should not do that. Unless there's a big reason. Like, I had a client once that scheduled me for an appointment, to an in-home family therapy appointment, and the daughter had died tragically and suddenly the night before. And so they called me for an emergency session, and so I scheduled them for an hour, and I showed up, and you know, as we're getting close to the end of the hour, I was just like, we're nowhere near being done with this session. You know, it was just a big family in their living room, and the session ended up going 3 hours. So I quote unquote went over, but in that scenario, it was important to do that. I had the time to do that. The clients wanted to do that. So yeah, can you go over sometimes? Sure. You know, are some therapists a little looser with that sort of thing? Yeah, but I don't recommend it. You know, I never get complaints from clients about ending on time. I mean, occasionally a client will be like, oh man, you know, maybe we should schedule longer meetings or something. And I'm like, yeah, we can talk about that. But I do hear, because I'm really anal about ending on time. And very occasionally I will go over if, you know, I have a client who we reach, like this actually happened not too long ago with a client that it was in literally the last like 30 seconds of the session. And I think it was me that brought something up, and I thought it was just kind of a wrap up thing to say to the session, to, you know, some sort of summary, and it opened up a can of worms with the clients. And I was like, oh, I shouldn't have said that. And then it was my fault. So I was like, I can't just end the session right now because it would feel really weird. And, you know, now that I think about it out loud, I probably could have ended it, but because I felt guilty, I didn't want to. So that's another thing that often is the reason why therapists will go over, is because the therapist isn't aware of their unjustified shame that they feel about themselves, because that's often a driver of that kind of thing. And I think that was at play for me at the time. But I didn't go too far over. I, you know, my sessions end on the 10, you know, on the 50. When the big hand gets to the 10, that's when I end sessions. And I think we went for another 12 minutes or something. And I didn't have a client afterwards, so it didn't matter. But the reason why we want to keep the frame of therapy is so that, you know, if you go over one, you're likely to bleed into the next session. And as you know, you clients out there who have therapists who show up late, you know how that feels. It doesn't feel good, especially when you're on time. So you're not doing anyone any favors by doing that, including your own practice. But also, if you go over with a client one day and then the next day you don't, particularly if the client has sensitivities around abandonment, then they might think, oh, I wasn't a good client today. That's why my therapist didn't reward me with going over. Like, just end the fucking session on time. It's not hard to do. As a therapist, I remember thinking this when I started out, because it was kind of hard in the beginning for me, because you feel bad when you're starting out, just abruptly ending. You know, it's not how things usually go in life, right? Especially when someone is talking about something very personal and they're crying. It's not normal to, in a social situation or even with a coworker, to just suddenly say, oh, sorry, time's up, we have to end this conversation. It feels very, very weird and rude, right? But you just got to get used to it. You also learn ways to ramp the client down. Like, if I was, you know, when the big hand gets to the 9 and I had a client that was still kind of in the midst of a lot of emotion and crying or something, I might say to them, so we have about 5 minutes left, but I really want to hear more about this. So I just want to remind you about that. Plus, we can talk about this next time, and I think we should. But I just want to remind you. But, you know, please continue. So I'm preparing them, right, so that it just doesn't come out of left field, because, you know, clients don't necessarily look at the clock as they're going through a session. I actually don't encourage clients to look at the clock, because I'll remind them. You know, they client, especially if it's a long term client with me, they can usually kind of tell by the rhythm of my language that we're getting closer to the end, because there's certain ways that I talk at the end of a session. Anyway, so yeah, just, you know, keep it in your pants. Don't date clients, and as a much minor issue, end your sessions on time. Going on here, he has also initiated 3 hugs with me. Just chiming in. Yeah, again, in and of itself, not unlikely an issue, because you can certainly do that as a therapist, but it's not recommended that men initiate hugs with women clients, especially unless you really ask or something. But, you know, I've hugged clients before. I don't think I've ever initiated one. Well, maybe I have with men. It would always be with men if I was initiating, but that's not common. Anyway, so you take all this into it. So those are all the different behaviors. You know, it doesn't look good. It doesn't. There's an off chance. I would give, you know, like a 3% chance that if we had videotape and we heard from the therapist that there wouldn't be a problem here. And, you know, you'd be like, no, this and that and dee-dee-dee-da-da. There's a small chance, but, you know, given everything we're hearing, it doesn't sound good. And the thing that I think the YouTube member is leaving out is that she's also attracted to the client or to the therapist. She is having those feelings. I don't know to what extent, but so it's not like he's just, it's not one directional. It sounds like it's at least somewhat two directional. It sounds like maybe more from him, but anyway, going on with the email. He is 44 years old and single with no kids. He has talked to me about women that he dated. Again, just chiming in. There's nothing inherently wrong with that kind of self-disclosure, but when we take everything into account, it is worrisome. Worrisome in that I'm worried for the client. Pretty worried for the client. And there's, what word do I put to it? I'm worried that this... So even if the client, the emailer in, were to end the relationship now and say, yeah, I think this is going down a weird road. It might even be going down a weird road for me and my attraction. So, I'm going to terminate. I'll find another therapist. There's a possibility, and I've worked with people like this before, where for the next 10 years, the client could still be reeling and having a variety of emotions afterwards, from loss to longing to hurt and anger, feeling betrayed, right? Because it's a sacred bond, a therapist and a client. There's a vulnerability that a client hands over to us. And for us to play around with that and to be attracted to someone and to entertain or flippantly play around with the possibility of dating or something, it's violating to the client. And often is seen that way by clients. Not always right away. It can feel that way because when you're in the midst of the lovey-doveys, you only see the lovey-doveys. 5 years later, once the lovey-doveys wear off, is when you start to go like, well, wait, what? How come he was... I was the client. Well, yeah, and it can feel really violating. It's similar to like a rape, because the emotional vulnerability and how you just lay yourself open, right? And for someone to insert their own sexuality or romantic needs into that, it's violating. It's betraying, right? So this is why it's fucking important that people get trained on this and are monitored on this sort of shit, because it could be really devastating. That's another point I want to say, is there can be a real delayed negative effect for clients who go through this sort of thing. So if a client checks in with themselves, they're just like, well, I don't mind this, or I kind of like the attention. It's not necessarily true that you'll always feel positive about what's happening going on. I'm finding myself getting very attached to him emotionally, and it's hard keeping the space between us. Sometimes I daydream about being with him, but I know that can't happen. I'm not trying to be conceited, but I know I am reasonably attractive as a woman, and I'm fairly certain he likes me. Is he trying to create transference between us in the hopes of helping the therapeutic process? Just chiming in. Not likely. There is a possibility of that he is trying to create transference, maybe meaning that he's playing up or playing into his attraction to you to try to get you to be attracted to him. I mean, that's not the standard of practice, and I certainly can't see a reason why that would be justified, but I've never heard of such a thing. And really, the standard of practice, if you do anything along these lines, is to encourage parental transference, meaning that I might encourage a client to see me as a parent, which is, obviously very different than seeing me as a romantic partner, right? Now, if I have had this, it's very common for a client to be attracted to me or to be in love with me, to want to marry me. And it sounds funny. I'm not saying it's common that people fall in love with me, but it's par for the course. I would say, maybe even as high as 50% of clients who are borderline or histrionic or have similar schemas will have some sort of significant transference to me and all therapists that treat, you know, therapists who are like me, that are attachment oriented and long-term, you know, like Bob and me, it is commonplace for that to happen. And that all is normal and okay and expected and fine. So there's that. But I might, with all my clients, try to create a transference to me as a parent. Like, if I have a client who was neglected a lot emotionally, then I, in the back of my mind, or sometimes in the front of my mind, I'm very much not trying to manipulate my client, but trying to emphasize a vibe between us that is parental, and I am giving them attention, and to really make it a deeper corrective experience. You know, it's one thing to get attention from your therapist. It's another thing to get attention from a father figure. You know what I mean? And I'll be explicit with clients. You know, I don't play games with people. I'll say things like, we're talking about the fact that they were neglected and they weren't given enough attention. And I might overtly ask them, do you feel like I give you attention? Do you feel like I'm paying attention to you? One, I'm very curious, because I sometimes the dynamic can develop where they still feel like even I am not paying attention to. But you know, they say, yeah, I do. I do feel like you pay attention to me. And I might say, oh, that's good. I'm glad. And then I might even use fatherly language, you know, like, I'm really proud of you. And I think of you as, I have a lot of admiration for you. You know, there are things that I look up to you about, you know, you do this, this, and this. And I think that's really admirable. So I'm trying to bolster that transference. I've literally never in my mind thought I should try to bolster a romantic transference towards me, you know, that I should try to encourage a client to fall in love with me or be attracted to me or something. And even if I had, which I hadn't, I certainly wouldn't emulate an attraction to a client to encourage that. I can't imagine a clinical justification for that going on. I have mother neglect issues. So she's saying that she was neglected by her mom. I was also molested as a child. I was sexually coerced as a teenager, and I'm currently in an abusive relationship. My issues run pretty deep, but I feel like I'm a relatively strong person. I mainly wanted therapy for the validation that I was being abused and to help with my kids. Any thoughts on what is going on here? End of email. Right. So you're saying that, first off, that you have a lot of issues of being harmed. So it's kind of a perfect recipe for this sort of exploitation from a therapist that either doesn't know what they're doing or knows that they're, you know, harming clients in this way. If you were neglected by your mother, you know, there's a transference of that sort to therapists, right? Of just like, well, I really not only am craving attention and non-neglect, you know, I'm craving attunement and love from this therapist, but I needed a lot because I didn't get any of it growing up. And then you add the fact that that craving is good and fine, and in a normal transference, counter-transference relationship can be very corrective when a therapist does give attention to a client like that. But it also opens you up to be exploited, because you know, you're so desperate, you'll overlook things, or anyway. And then you've also been sexually coerced and molested as a child, as a teen. And that can, not always, lead to, and you've only, this is your first bout of therapy, and I'm reminding myself out loud. So, you know, you're probably at the very beginning of this sort of self-discovery and healing, at least to some extent. And I wouldn't be surprised if in 15 years, after you do a lot more recovery possibly with a different set of professionals, that you look back at this time and think that you were actually playing a script, that, you know, when you were young and you were being exploited, that there was a danger there, right? And when you were under danger and under threat by the people that were harming you, one of the, you know, you have fight, flight, freeze, appease, or fawn and faint, or, you know, it's various different words for it. But the word to focus on here is appease or fawn. And it's a very natural defense, a very helpful defense when we're being victimized and we're powerless as children, to turn off our internal self-preservation and to hand ourselves over, because it's better to be harmed under those circumstances than to be harmed when you're trying to get away, or you're trying to say no or resist. It's much safer to allow the harm to happen under your own appeasement. You know, you're appeasing the victimizer. Also, sometimes the victimizer will go easier on you if you're smiling during the abuse. So one of the things that'll happen over time, if that's repeated a lot, is in the moment of someone grooming you or harming you, you literally will not have access to your emotions or the self that is being harmed. So it doesn't feel like harm. It feels like you want it. Yet you might even become such an appeaser or such a fawner that you even encourage the abuse to happen. And I don't know if that's a mechanism at play for you, anonymous YouTube member, but I wouldn't be surprised if in 15 years you look back and you think, yeah, that absolutely was going on. That fucking bastard was supposed to be protecting me, and he was just another person that was abusing me and coercing me and harming me in that way. I mean, what the fuck? Therapists are not supposed to do that sort of thing. And I would agree with you when you say that in the future. And, you know, you say here, my issues run pretty deep, but I feel like I'm a relatively strong person. This has nothing to do, I'm sure you are very strong, but this has nothing to do with being strong or weak. I'm wondering if you have a stereotype of people who are victimized in these situations as being weak. No, anyone, especially someone who's been through what you've been through, regardless of how strong they are, can be absolutely harmed by this. The vast we've looked into this, and the research demonstrates the vast, vast majority of clients and of clients who engage in relationships with therapists. You could argue you're at the cusp of it, or even kind of, you've got at least one toe in the door there. Now, of course, this is none of your fault. This is all his fault. You have zero responsibility. You're free to be attracted to him. You're free to say that. You're free to fantasize about him or ask him out. You're free to do all those things, and there's nothing wrong with that. I've had, you know, dozens of clients do that to me, and I, at no point did I think I was being violated because, you know, the first time it happened, it was alarming. I was an intern, and it was a woman from Russia, actually. And she, I think, just didn't know that it was not what you're supposed to do. And I think I even had it captured it on audio. I was recording episodes for my classes, and I think I even, and it was the very end of session. Never forget that, actually. It's funny. I haven't thought about that one a long time. And I was caught so off guard. I was like, oh no, I'm sorry. Cause so unexpected, you know. Anyway, so you haven't done anything wrong, but the vast, vast majority of clients and therapists who enter into these kind of romantic sexual relationships, the vast majority of the clients will be massively traumatized and harmed, negatively impacted for the rest of their lives. It's not a casual thing that happens to clients. It's really ill-advised for him to be doing this. So we can't count on him, though, necessarily. I don't know. There's a chance that he does know what he's doing and everything's fine. I can't tell from a description, but there is a chance that we cannot depend on him to protect you, and we cannot depend on him to know what to do with this. And we can't rely on you to know what to do with this because you're the client, but you're the one that I'm talking to right now. And so if there's anything you can do to protect yourself, you should obviously do it, right? And this is what I would do if I were in your shoes, is one, I would put it in my mind as far away as possible that this is even COVID mind. What I would do first off is stop myself from consciously thinking that it was a viable option that the two of us would get together. Even though my heart and body might want to, I would remind myself, and I have a lot of episodes on this whole thing, by the way, YouTube member. Some of them might be for patrons. Yet might have to become a patron and listen to those, but that there's a fair amount of episode, you know, like a therapist kisses a client, a therapist. There's another one. There's a bunch of them. I've made erotic erotic countertransference might be a couple of the episodes. Anyway, that's one thing, because if you allow yourself to believe that it is something that is viable or that you want, it'll, I'm guessing, interfere with your ability to protect yourself moving forward. The other thing I would do, if you presented this case to a lot of people, including a lot of professionals, they would say terminate. And certainly you can, but that's often a simplistic answer that most clients won't do. So if you want to terminate, you can. Now, you know, you haven't talked about the therapy, if it's benefiting you a lot, because if it's benefiting you a lot, it's hard to find a good therapist, you know? So it's possible that, you know, a couple other options might be worth exploring. Now, if it continues and it gets worse, then termination is probably the only answer to protect you. But another possibility is that you could maybe rein it in a little bit. And here's what I would say to him, is I would say, so I've been thinking a lot about our relationship, and you know, you and I talk about attraction. You've said you've been attracted to me, and I did ask you if you wanted to meet up outside of therapy that one time, and you said that you couldn't because you'd lose your license or whatever. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about this whole thing, because I asked around about this, and people were saying that I should terminate with you, that I should fire you as my therapist, but I actually like coming to see you. People were telling me that you were going to harm me and that you were being unethical. And I don't know, I'm just curious what you think about that. Something like that. That's what I would say. And then I would just stop and listen to what the therapist, and I would really take note of what the therapist said. I might even ask the therapist to put it in writing. I'd be like, you know, could you put it in writing? Because I want to ask a friend of mine about your response. So could you put it in writing? If the therapist is on the up and up, which is slightly possible, like if, let's say I'm the therapist and a client came to me and said something like that to me, I am on the up and up. So what I would say is the following. I would say, oh my God, I'm so sorry that I did that. I mean, that is awful. It sounds like you've been thinking about this, and I am so sorry. I really did fail as a therapist in this way. And I'm glad that you brought up, thank you. I do have some issues, and I guess I should be talking with a supervisor or my therapist about this. So I'll do that. I guess I've just been a little too loose about things with you. I think maybe because I feel like we could have been friends outside of therapy, but that's no excuse. I'm a therapist. I should have known better. I really made a mistake there. I'm sorry. And I've been doing it for a while, so I'm going to really try to stop that. And we can get back to working on therapy. And you want it in writing? Absolutely. After we adjourn today, I'll write up a whole thing and send it to you, and you can bring that around to wherever you want. You know, that's what I would say. And I would have no problem doing that. I would document the shit out of the session, and I would get consultation and document the shit out of that. I would have follow-up conversations with the client afterwards and document the shit out of that. Not only because I care, but also, like, this is a lawsuit waiting to happen, obviously. Now, if the therapist says anything, that's pretty far afield from that, like, what are you talking about? Or, just suddenly terminates with you without any kind of explanation, then I don't know. To me, you have your answer. You're like, oh, this isn't going to work well. Not only in this dimension, but how can I trust them with anything beyond this at this point because of the incompetence that's being displayed right now, you know? So, that's what I would do. Number one is I would put my thoughts in check and say, stop entertaining. I'm saying this to myself. If I was you, the client, I'd be like, I need to really stop entertaining this notion that somehow he and I, the other thing, and one of the things you can tell yourself along these lines is, well, yeah, under this circumstance, we seem to have an attraction and compatibility, if you will, that is emulative of a romantic compatibility. But there is no fucking way I can know if we're actually compatible, because this is such a different context where I come, and that's another complaint that former clients will say when they are in a relationship with their former therapist is, before, when he was my therapist, I loved him because he was the best listener and he was so caring and compassionate, and I've never had a partner that was like that. Well, now that we live together or we're dating, he doesn't listen. He never listens to me anymore, or he doesn't listen to me the way he used to. And it's like, well, yeah, because he was your therapist. Now I don't blame clients, but if you are in that situation, you should know that, for example, Stacy, my wife, does not see me the way my clients see me. My clients will see me as this idyllic, some of you actually see me as this idyllic person, and believe me, if you were Stacy in her shoes, you would not see me that way. So that's normal. A lot of you see Bob in this idyllic way. Believe me, if you were Colleen, I'm guessing you wouldn't see Bob in that way. It might be really hard to even imagine that, right? But it's a very different, it's not a bad relationship, but it's a very different relationship. And filled with glory and frustration like any other marriage. So that's another thing to tell yourself, anonymous YouTube member, that you're having an attraction to him in this context. And there's a really good chance that if you were legit going to date him. Now, I know you're not saying you want to date him because you're just like, that's never going to happen. But the sooner you can kind of clamp down on those those kind of urges. There's nothing wrong with, you know, having a sort of flighty attraction or what if kind of a thing. It's another thing to be thinking the way that I think that you and him are thinking. Now, if I was talking to him, it'd be a much different story. I would be telling him, look, dude, this is 100% your responsibility. You have to clean up this shit, and you have to, we have to figure out whether or not you need to pull back from clients altogether. Cause some, you know, I'm only saying these things to you because I don't have the opportunity to say something to him. If I did have access to both of you, I wouldn't give you any advice because this is asking way too much of you as a client. Your therapist should be having all these conversations with you and doing all the necessary things so that you don't have to, you know, do anything. You know, like I was saying earlier, clients will sometimes fall in love with me. It's my job to figure out how to deal with that, how to help the client within that context. I would never tell the client, oh boy, well, you know, you got to figure out how to manage your feelings so that you can show up in therapy. That's stupid, right? I would never do that. But so I want to be clear that I'm only giving you advice because I don't have access to him. Another thing you can do, now that I'm thinking about it, is you have the therapist listen to this episode and just say, hey, I want you to listen to this episode in your free time, and then we can talk about it in the next session, and then see what he says. You know, again, I don't know the situation, and if he were here, maybe he'd be like, no, there's this and that, and, you know, I just don't know, but that's another option. So, yeah. Well, that went on a lot longer than I thought it would. It's 2 hours. I guess it's just been a while since I've had a chance to talk about this, and I had I felt like it'd be good to, you know, lay all this out again. There was a time when it was a frequent thing that we would talk about on this podcast 8 years ago-ish or something. I'm not sure exactly why, but not so much in the last number of years. And so maybe that's why I turned this one email into an entire episode. All right. Well, everyone out there, please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really do.